Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. So welcome to this Dharma study class. This afternoon we're going to be looking at Sutta number 78 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Samana Mandika Putta Sutta. And I've chosen this sutta this afternoon to be like the cornerstone of a teaching that I've been giving over the weekend on intention. So we're going to go through this sutta, but we're also going to look at a couple of other places in the Sutta Pitaka where intention is talked about. And in terms of right intention, intention is part of the Noble Eightfold Path, Samma Sankappa, and it is defined in all places when it refers to the Noble Eightfold Path, as right intention is the intention towards renunciation, towards loving kindness, and towards non-cruelty or compassion. And so that's really the benchmark for intention in our life, to see whether we are acting on that kind of motivation with that kind of goal in mind. So that's that kind of right intention. But there's also the way in which we understand intention to be more like a mental factor, a sankhara, that is specifically to do with volition or will. And then we call it, very often it's called in Pali, chetana. The way that we instigate action in the world in order to get the result in the world that we want. So today we're going to look at how the Buddha talked about right intention and intention generally, and then how this is also related to the mental factor of sankhara, and specifically the mental factor that we call volition, chetana or will. And we'll start with the sutta that I mentioned that we're going to look through, sutta number 78. And we'll go through that, and then as the opportunity arises to look at the other suttas, we'll do so. So the other suttas that we're going to refer to will be also one in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Great 40 Sutta, 117, and then also part of sutta number 9 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Right View Sutta, which is a teaching given by Venerable Sariputta. But starting with sutta number 78, the Samana Mandika Putta Sutta. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's park. Now on that occasion the wanderer Ugahama Hamana, Samana Mandika Putta, was staying in Malika's park, the single-hauled Tinduka plantation for philosophical debates, together with a large following of wanderers, with as many as 300 wanderers. And this was a park which was built by Queen Malika, who was the disciple of the Buddha, and the wife of King Pasenadi of Kosala. And when the Buddha went to stay in Sarvati and to stay at the Jeta Grove, then she built this other monastery or a park where there were planted many trees and it was a very beautiful area, and then gradually several halls for debates were built there, and wanderers from different traditions, not the Sangha of the Buddha, but different philosophers and ascetics would gather in these halls to engage in debate. So the carpenter Panchakanga went out from Sarvati at midday in order to see the Blessed One. Now he is one of the disciples of the Buddha who's mentioned a number of times in the suttas as being a very good lay disciple, someone who had well-grounded faith in the Buddha and who was also a good meditator. And he's a disciple and he often went to hear the discourses of the Buddha. So he went out from Sarvati at midday in order to see the Blessed One. And then he thought, it is not the right time to see the Blessed One. He's still in retreat and it is not right, the right time to see bhikkhus worthy of esteem. They are still in retreat. Suppose I went to Malika's park to the wanderer Ugahamana Samana Mandikaputta, and he went to Malika's park. Just as an aside, there's a very interesting sutta where the king of Kosala, King Pasenadi, says that although Panchakanga is his carpenter, the royal carpenter, and works for him and receives his salary from the king, that he knows that when he goes to sleep, when Panchakanga goes to sleep, he always makes sure that he's sleeping with his head towards wherever the Buddha is now, that he pays more respect to the Buddha than he does to his master who's giving him his livelihood. This is just an aside to show that this carpenter was a very faithful and wise disciple of the Buddha. Now, on that occasion, the wanderer Ugahamana was seated with a large assembly of wanderers who were making an uproar, loudly and noisily talking many kinds of pointless talk, such talk as talk of kings. And we just go over to sutta number 76, and this is a standard outline of the sort of noisy and useless talk that the wanderers of other sects would engage in. Noisily talking many kinds of pointless talk, such as talk of kings, robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, battles, food, drink, clothing, beds, garlands, perfume, relatives, vehicles, villages, towns, cities, countries, women, heroes, streets, wells, the dead, trifles, the origin of the world, the origin of the sea, whether things are so or not so. So the sort of things you read in the newspaper and you sit around talking about. Those are the things which are considered to be pointless talk. So the wanderer Ugahamana Samana Mandikaputta saw the carpenter Panchakanga coming in the distance. Seeing him, he quieted his own assembly thus, "Sirs, be quiet. Sirs, make no noise. Here comes the carpenter Panchakanga, a disciple of the recluse Gotama, one of the recluse Gotama's white-clothed lay disciples staying at Sarvati. These venerable ones like quiet. They are disciplined in quiet. They commend quiet. Perhaps if he finds our assembly a quiet one, he will think to join us." Then the wanderers became silent. The carpenter Panchakanga went to the wanderer Ugahamana and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side. And then the wanderer said to him, "Carpenter, when a man possesses four qualities, I describe him as accomplished in what is wholesome, perfected in what is wholesome, attained to the supreme attainment, an ascetic invincible. What are the four? He does no evil bodily actions, he utters no evil speech, he has no evil intentions, and he does not make his living by any evil livelihood. When a man possesses these four qualities, I describe him as accomplished in what is wholesome, perfected in what is wholesome, attained to the supreme attainment, an ascetic invincible. Then the carpenter Panchakanga neither approved nor disapproved of the wanderer Ugahamana's words. Without doing either, he rose from his seat and went away, thinking, I shall learn the meaning of this statement in the presence of the Blessed One. So this ascetic is describing someone who, in the Buddhist terminology, would be an arahant, one who's perfected all wholesome qualities, has attained the supreme attainment and is invincible. So Panchakanga is going to see what the Buddha has to say about this description of an enlightened one. Then he went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and reported to the Blessed One his entire conversation with the wanderer Ugahamana. Thereupon the Blessed One said, If that were so, carpenter, then the young tender infant lying prone is accomplished in what is wholesome, perfected in what is wholesome, attained to the supreme attainment, an ascetic invincible, according to the wanderer Ugahamana's statement. For a young tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion body, so how could he do an evil action beyond mere wriggling? A young tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion speech, so how could he utter evil speech beyond mere whining? A young tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion intention, so how should he have evil intentions beyond mere sulking? A young tender infant lying prone does not even have the notion livelihood, so how should he make his living by evil livelihood beyond being suckled at his mother's breast? If that were so, carpenter, then the young tender infant lying prone is accomplished in what is wholesome, according to the wanderer Ugahamana's statement. So we see the little babies lying around here wriggling and doing things just as babies do. So the Buddha's saying, because they don't have any concept of what they're doing, that you can't say that they've attained perfection because it's just not within their scope of experience. So the Buddha goes on to say, when a man possesses four qualities, carpenter, I describe him not as accomplished in what is wholesome, or perfected in what is wholesome, or attained to the supreme attainment, or an ascetic invincible, but as one who stands in the same category as the young tender infant lying prone. What are the four? Here he does no evil bodily actions, he utters no evil speech, he has no evil intentions, and he does not make his living by any evil livelihood. When a man possesses these four qualities, I describe him not as accomplished, but as one who stands in the same category as the young tender infant lying prone. Now, you may think that this is quite a harsh statement from the Buddha, because if we were in the position of not ever doing any evil bodily actions or uttering any evil speech or having no evil intentions or not making our living by an evil livelihood, that would be a very high standard of virtue. But the Buddha's going to go on to show that there has to be an understanding of how those things come into be and how to actually work towards accomplishing those goals, and how one knows when one has moved in the right direction and is on the path to accomplishing those goals, and then what is the culmination of that path of practice. So although it seems like a very negative statement of the Buddha's to dismiss this kind of explanation of one who's accomplished, we'll see how the Buddha takes it to a much deeper level in not only describing what would be desirable, but also outlining how it can be accomplished. When a man possesses 10 qualities, carpenter, I describe him as accomplished in what is wholesome, perfected in what is wholesome, attained to the supreme attainment, and ascetic invincible. This is the Buddha's description of an arahant, a fully enlightened one. But first of all, I say, it must be understood thus. These are unwholesome habits, and thus unwholesome habits originate from this. And thus unwholesome habits cease without remainder here. And thus one practicing in this way is practicing the way to the cessation of unwholesome habits. And I now say it must be understood thus. These are wholesome habits, and thus wholesome habits originate from this. And thus wholesome habits cease without remainder here. And thus, one practicing in this way is practicing the way to the cessation of wholesome habits. And perhaps I better explain it now. In the way that the Buddha is setting out this framework, he's giving an explanation which calls on the framework of the Four Noble Truths. This is the cause of suffering, and this is where suffering comes from. This is the path of practice to attain the end of suffering. And it is possible to know when one has reached that state. So when the Buddha is talking about the framework, he's also saying what needs to be understood, what is the basis for the wholesome and the unwholesome, so that we know what we're working with. And ultimately, when we get to the point of the arahat, who's fully overcome greed, hatred and delusion, and part of that delusion is the wrong view of self, there is no more a sense of I am doing these good things. And so the idea of making good karma as opposed to bad karma is no longer applicable, because there's no sense of an individual person who's making that good karma. And so here we see when it says, I say halfway down verse 9, and I say it must be understood. These are unwholesome intentions, and thus unwholesome intentions originate from this, and thus unwholesome intentions cease without remainder here. And thus, one practicing in this way is practicing the way to the cessation of unwholesome intentions. And I say it must be understood, these are wholesome intentions, and thus wholesome intentions originate from this, and thus wholesome intentions cease without remainder here. And one practicing in this way is practicing the way to the cessation of wholesome intentions. So what we're going to see is that when one is on the path to accomplishing these goals, that is of the overcoming of the unwholesome and increasing the wholesome, that one is on the path to eradicating defilements, and that different stages on the path to enlightenment, different defilements fall away, are completely overcome, and they cease without remainder. So at the stage of the non-returner, the defilement of sensual desire, of craving for sensual pleasure is completely overcome. And the defilement of ill will is completely overcome. And so at that point, when one is having the intention to practice to overcome these defilements, and then they cease without remainder, then the intention to overcome them then is able to cease, because they're no longer existing. They no longer have to be dealt with. And this is the progressive outline which the Buddha is giving, that as these unwholesome qualities in the mind are progressively overcome, and at the time of the past moment they are given up, and then the fruit is that they no longer exist in the mind, then they cease without remainder, and the intention to work with those no longer applies. If you have any questions, please ask. So now, what are unwholesome habits? They are unwholesome bodily actions, unwholesome verbal actions, and evil livelihood. These are called unwholesome habits. So the word, the Pali word that's used here for habits is the word sila, which in this context means actions, but a much broader field of action than just the sila, which applies to the good actions of virtuous actions. And what do these unwholesome habits originate from? Their origin is stated, they should be said to originate from mind. What mind? Though mind is multiple, varied, and of different aspects, there is mind affected by lust, by hate, and by delusion. Unwholesome habits originate from this. And so the Buddha is saying, with all of the unwholesome qualities in the mind, the basic origin of all these is greed, hatred, and delusion. These are the defilements which are present and are the root of our suffering. And where do these unwholesome habits cease without remainder? Their cessation is stated, a bhikkhu abandons bodily misconduct and develops good bodily conduct. He abandons verbal misconduct and develops good verbal conduct. He abandons mental misconduct and develops good mental conduct. He abandons wrong livelihood and gains a living by right livelihood. It is here that unwholesome habits cease without remainder. And so this is the point of stream entry. So we're talking here, although it's not mentioned specifically, when it says that these habits cease without remainder, it has to be at a point of accomplishing a stage on the path to enlightenment. Otherwise, they don't cease without remainder. And so in the attainment of the first stage on the path, the stream winner, then the doubt in the truth of the Buddha's teaching falls away and there is right view. One knows the consequences of one's behaviour. One knows cause and effect as an experience. So the performance of wholesome actions leads to happiness. The performance of unwholesome actions leads to suffering. And because you know that, you put that into place in your life. You know that as a fact. There's also a commitment to a life guided by the five precepts, because one sees at a very deep level the consequences of acting unskillfully. And so the five precepts is something that one commits oneself to do, and it becomes much more of an effortless activity. But because one still has greed and hatred in the mind, there are going to be times when one is challenged even by keeping the five precepts, because there is still a tendency to pursue one's own gain, one's own satisfaction in the world, and there will come times when one is challenged to keep the precepts. But so in this sense, when we say that the unwholesome habits cease without remainder, at the point of stream winning, because greed and hatred are still present in the mind, that is not that they disappear completely. But the other thing that falls away at stream winning is the belief in personality view. There's no longer a sense of I am who I thought I was. That is an identification with this mind and this body as who we really are. And so if we have that kind of skepticism about who we really are and our place in scheme of things, our place in the world, then our sense of happiness and unhappiness is no longer so bound up in what we can accomplish in the material world. So this is one of the things that starts to be undermined at the point of stream winning. So one's much more focused on one's spiritual quest. And so this is one of the supports for one's further progress on the path, because one has found the truth of the teaching for oneself and one has experienced the feeling of relief, the feeling of great happiness at having seen for oneself where true safety lies. And how practicing does he practice the way to the cessation of unwholesome habits? Here a bhikkhu awakens zeal for the non-arising of unarisen, evil, unwholesome states, and he makes effort, arouses energy, exerts his mind and strives. He awakens zeal for the abandoning of arisen, evil, unwholesome states. He awakens zeal for the arising of unarisen, wholesome states. He awakens zeal for the continuance, non-disappearance, strengthening, increase and fulfillment by development of arisen wholesome states. And he makes effort, arouses energy, exerts his mind and strives. One so practicing practices the way to the cessation of unwholesome states. And so this is right effort applied so that the unwholesome states which haven't already arisen, one exerts one's energy not to feed them and not to cultivate them so that they don't arise. And when they do arise, one immediately sees them for what they are and replaces them with a wholesome state. And the wholesome states that arise naturally, one notices, one recognizes their benefit, and one does what is necessary to keep them going, and one actively cultivates wholesome states of mind. So this requires right effort applied not only in meditation but throughout a daily life, and is supported by a commitment to the precepts, because the precepts forewarn us of the areas of our life where we need to be careful. Those areas of our life particularly where we engage with the world through speech and through action.
Yes. If you think about why it makes really good sense. Well, but so often we know that these things are logical and a really good idea. What are the causal conditions to generate the zeal that the Buddha talks about? In other words, one step back from making my effort.
Yes. So one first of all really has to see that it's beneficial. And so to be mindful and apply one's attention to see what's really going on in one's life. And the meditation is the way of being able to open up the mind to see that, because when we sit in meditation, we first of all experience directly that the mind is running riot, that it's not following our intentions, that is to stay with the meditation object or to have loving thoughts or whatever. So the meditation is really important. And the mindfulness that we establish there, we then carry over into our daily life. So we start to really see what is the cause and effect for happiness in my life. How does it really work in fact, not just in theory? And it's seeing that again and again that eventually makes us feel, well, it's worth doing. And then we put in the effort. And then part of right effort, one of the factors or aspects of right effort, is to gradually start to guard the senses and to realise what things in one's life affect the state of one's mind. So it's not just seeing cause and effect once we've got it in the mind and once it comes out in our speech or our behaviour, but starting to see how the sort of environment that we're in, the sort of company we keep, all of those things actually affects our mind. And then how the state of mind that we're in affects what comes out in our speech and our behaviour. So we're gradually broadening the circle. And that's by having the direct experience, then we get the zeal. Because here's the teaching that's explaining all this, and we only have to put into practice the instructions we're given. So we're up to verse 11. What are the wholesome habits? There are wholesome bodily actions, wholesome verbal actions, and purification of livelihood. These are called wholesome habits. And what do these wholesome habits originate from? Their origin is stated that they should be said to originate from mind. What mind? Though mind is multiple, varied, and of different aspects, there is mind unaffected by lust, by hate, and by delusion. Wholesome habits originate from this. And where do these wholesome habits cease without remainder? Their cessation is stated. Here a bhikkhu is virtuous, but he does not identify with his virtue, and he understands as it actually is that deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom where these wholesome habits cease without remainder. So we'll just look up the wording for that in the commentary. And it says, this passage shows the arahant who maintains virtuous conduct but no longer identifies with his virtue by conceiving it as I and mine. Since his virtuous habits no longer generate karma, they are not described as wholesome. So up until the path of, leading to the state of arahatship and these various stages on the path to enlightenment, one is practicing and making the effort to increase wholesome states and allow unwholesome states to cease. And one is doing that temporarily as one practices. And then eventually at the stage of the path and the fruit of the path, then those unwholesome habits, they're described here, fall away completely. Because the greed, the hatred and delusion, which is their basis, has fallen away completely. And so the fully enlightened arahat continues to act virtuously, not through keeping precepts, but because it's just a natural way of being in the world, because there's no longer a sense of self or I or things that belong to me that have to be protected, that have to be guarded, that have to be multiplied in order to be satisfied. So then we say this practices the way to the cessation of wholesome habits, not that the arahat ceases to act virtuously, but ceases to identify with these as wholesome habits. I should do this. What are unwholesome intentions? They are the intention of sensual desire, the intention of ill will, and the intention of cruelty. These are called unwholesome intentions. And what do these unwholesome intentions originate from? Their origin is stated. They should be said to originate from perception. What perception? Though perception is multiple, varied, and different aspects, there is perception of sensual desire, perception of ill will, and perception of cruelty. Unwholesome intentions originate from this. So earlier it was said that the unwholesome intentions originate from mind. And so what we're getting at is that these things are all aspects of the mind, and here it is narrowed down to perception, but perception arises only on the necessary condition of contact with the world. Through contact with the world, perception arises. Contact through the senses, any of the sense doors, the eye door, the ear door, the nose door, the tongue door, the body door, there's a contact with the world that gives rise to feeling and perception. And although it's stated here as perception is the origin of these states, it is the mind in movement out into the world. And then trying to produce in the world and in our experience the kind of thing that we want. So the intention arises to produce in our experience to the thing that we want, the situation, the experience, to get what we want or to avoid what we don't want. So it's because of contact with the world that this intention arises, and then this intention gives rise to speech and action. And where do these unwholesome intentions cease without remainder? Their cessation is stated here: quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, and with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, it is here that unwholesome intentions cease without remainder. Now, here we're saying that, talking about intentions that cease without remainder, here is not, we're not just talking about the normal attainment of a jhanic state of meditation, which of course is impermanent, and the pleasure that's experienced in that jhanic state is also temporary. But in this particular sutta, this is referring to the state of absorption at the time of a path moment on the stage, the stages to enlightenment. The stream entry is accompanied by a level of meditative absorption to the level of jhana. Every moment, every stage on the path, for the stream winner, for the once returner, the non-returner, and for the arahat, the level of meditative absorption at that point of path moment has to be at the level of jhana. So when this refers to the unwholesome intentions ceasing without remaining, in this case where there are the ill will and the cruelty, also the sensual desire, this would be referring to the non-returner, who at the stage of the path and fruit of non-returning, sensual desire and ill will fall away completely. Now, on the path to enlightenment, the way that we meet many, many times in the suttas, the way of overcoming craving is to experience the jhanas, because the pleasure that comes from the jhanas, the sense of fulfillment and satisfaction that comes from the jhanas becomes a replacement for ordinary worldly craving. And so when we talk about the development of the mind through the jhanas, we talk about the deliverance of the mind through this kind of absorption. The deliverance of the mind through wisdom, panya-vimutti, as opposed to chaito-vimutti, is the wisdom that overcomes ignorance. And the twin causes of suffering and causes of rebirth are craving and ignorance. So the experience of the jhanas is always linked to the overcoming of craving, to the weakening of craving. And the overcoming of ignorance is always linked to the wisdom that arises dependent on this very stable and strong mind that's developed through the meditative absorptions. And so when we're talking here about the overcoming of the perception of sensual desire, the perception of ill will, the perception of cruelty, this is a mind which has grown great through the overcoming of self-centered desire, self-centered craving, and no longer the need to compete or overwhelm others, other things, in order to attain a state of inner satisfaction. So to get to the state of non-returning and to be able to abide in that state and to receive the fruit of that state, one's already weakened along the path the craving for sensual desire. And craving for sensual desire so often brings us into conflict with others because they have what we want or they stop us getting what we want. And how practicing does he practice the way to the cessation of unwholesome intentions? Here a bhikkhu awakens zeal for the non-arising of unarisen even evil unwholesome states, for the continuance, non-disappearance, strengthening, increase and fulfillment by development of arisen wholesome states. And he makes effort, arouses energy, exerts his mind and strives. One so practicing practices the way to the cessation of unwholesome intentions. And what are wholesome intentions? They are the intention of renunciation, the intention of non-ill will, and the intention of non-cruelty. These are called wholesome intentions. And what do these wholesome intentions originate from? Their origin is stated that they should be said to originate from perception. What perception? Though perception is multiple, varied, and of different aspects, there is perception of renunciation, perception of non-ill will, and perception of non-cruelty. Wholesome intentions originate from this. And where do these wholesome intentions cease without remainder? Their cessation is stated. Here, with the stilling of applied and sustained thought, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the second jhana, which has self-confidence and singleness of mind without applied and sustained thought. With rapture and pleasure born of concentration, it is here that these wholesome intentions cease without remainder. Now this is not just the ordinary second jhana being described here, this is the fruit of arahatship, where the mind experiences the joy and the happiness of having overcome completely greed, hatred and delusion. And the happiness that arises out of that. One doesn't have to do anything to make that happen. It is simply there as a result, first of the past moment, which sees the eradication of these defilements, and then the fruit, which experiences the mind free completely of greed, hatred and delusion. And how practicing does he practice the way to the cessation of wholesome intentions? Here a bhikkhu awakens zeal for the non-arising of unarisen evil unwholesome states, for the continuance, non-disappearance, strengthening, increase and fulfillment by development of arisen wholesome states, and he makes effort, arouses energy, exerts his mind and strives. One so practicing practices the way to the cessation of wholesome intentions. Now, in all of this, what we keep seeing is that there has to be a recognition of the difference between wholesome and unwholesome. And then there has to be the intention to practice for the reduction of the unwholesome and the cultivation of the wholesome. And also in this sutta, although it's not pointed out so overtly, we are seeing that all of these things, the real aim of all of these things is to take us all the way to enlightenment, not just to have wholesome thought, speech and action for the sake of being a virtuous person, for having worldly happiness and success, but for it to be the basis for the cultivation of the path to liberation. And so I'd like to go on to just read to you part of the sutta number 117, where the Buddha talks about the way in which we need to cultivate intention not just with the idea of having worldly success, and in fact he even calls it wrong intention when we are looking at things just from the point of view of how can this make me happy here in this world now. So from sutta number 117, the Great 40, the Buddha says, I shall teach you noble concentration with its supports and requisites. And what bhikkhus is noble concentration with its supports and requisites? That is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, and right mindfulness. That is, right concentration supported by the other seven factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. And unification of mind equipped with these seven factors is called noble right concentration with supports and its requisites. So what we're talking about here when we talk about noble right concentration is the concentration that is super mundane, that is the concentration of the path and fruit moments that take the mind out of the normal worldly way of things into the world of the noble ones, the Aryas. And to just get a sense of how we do this, and that's what the previous sutta was saying, this is what you have to do, this is the thing that you have to follow, but how do we do that? That's what this next sutta is going into, and I will just read a couple of sections of it. The first section is view, starting on verse 4. Remembering that we're talking about the whole of the Noble Eightfold Path, but here is the first section on view. Therein, bhikkhus, right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong view as wrong view and right view as right view. This is one's right view. And what bhikkhus is wrong view? There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed, no fruit or result of good or bad actions, no this world, no other world, no mother, no father, no beings who are born spontaneously, no good and virtuous recluses and brahmins in the world who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other. This is wrong view. So this is basically the dismissal of cause and effect, that there are these things and there's a cause for why there are things and that there is an effect for the things that we do that create these results. And what bhikkhus is right view? Right view, I say, is twofold. There is right view that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening on the side of attachment. And there is right view that is noble, taintless, supermundane, a factor of the path. And what bhikkhus is right view that is affected by the taints, partaking of merit, ripening on the side of attachment? There is what is given and what is offered and what is sacrificed. There is fruit and the result of good and bad actions. There is this world and the other world. There is mother and father. There are beings who are born spontaneously. There are in this world good and virtuous recluses and brahmins who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge and declare this world and the other world. This is right view affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening on the side of attachment. And so this kind of right view, the Buddha is saying, is correct in its understanding, but it's affected by taints in that there is still this sense of wanting something out of it, to get something out of this understanding of what is and what isn't, of cause and effect, the offering of dana, the doing of good, the doing of merit is done with a sense of I and mine. It's with a sense of getting a result that will help one in this life. It's not done with the intention of getting out of samsara. So in this way, the Buddha isn't saying it's wrong view, it is right view, but it's affected by taints, as partaking of merit, ripening on the side of attachment. There's still an attachment to this world. And what bhikkhus is right view that is noble, taintless, supermundane, a factor of the path? The wisdom, the faculty of wisdom, the power of wisdom, the investigation of state's enlightenment factor, the path factor of right view, in one whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, who possesses the noble path and is developing the noble path. This is right view that is noble, taintless, supermundane, a factor of the path. One makes an effort to abandon wrong view and to enter upon right view. So that's the first one. One makes this right effort. And mindfully one abandons wrong view, mindfully one enters upon and abides in right view. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus these three states run and circle around right view. That is right view, right effort and right mindfulness. So this comes back to the question of how do we do it? How do we get onto it? And so what the Buddha is saying in this is that it's very good to have the right view, but if we are still thinking in terms of making our life in this world as pleasant as possible and also producing the conditions for a favourable rebirth in another world after the end of this life, then we're still practicing with attachment. And we may say, well, it's better to practice with attachment because we can't overcome all the defilements so quickly. So isn't it better to at least do good than to not do it? And that's what the Buddha is saying. Yes, it is. But to gradually see the difference between practicing for one's happiness in this world and practicing to get out. Because if one is practicing to get out, from the other sutta we see that the level of concentration that is needed to break through is the level of jhana. And how do we start to develop jhana? Jhana has to be as a result of reducing craving for the world, reducing craving for the material world, reducing craving for our usual way of finding happiness. Unless we gradually rein in the world, rein in the desire for the world, then the mind will never be able to access the happiness of the mind. And unless the mind, that happiness is developed and made much of, the mind will never reach the point of jhanic absorption. And so it's a step-by-step process. We have to see that we can't just, through wishing, attain a mind which is ready to abide with itself and be satisfied if we are feeding it constantly on things from outside. So that's the point that I'm trying to emphasize. And the next section is on intention.
Yes. Question here in terms of how one would have an appreciation of moving in that direction and what it talks in the true direction of moving towards enlightenment. At a very practical level, does one experience the sense of the world as being more of or oneself in the world as not being so, take yourself so seriously?
The question is, how does one experience that in a practical sense? The delight in the world falls away. And one sees, it's not just that one gives up what one would like to do, but one's delight in it falls away because one sees that it's incapable of offering anything substantial. And then there's much more a feeling of being complete without all of those things. They're unnecessary. So there's much more that sense of being able to maintain a sense of equilibrium without being so either drawn to the world's attractions or repelled by the world that we don't like.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
So the question is, even though your attachments may fall away, even say to people, is there still a general concern for them, and not just a concern for them because of your own attachment? Yes, and this is a very crucial point, because it's very often misunderstood. The Arahant is full of loving kindness and compassion, and that's wisdom arising with compassion. So that it's not that one becomes heartless and cold. In fact, one is more concerned for other beings than ever. But one realizes also the limitations of one's concern, because ultimately that being's situation is determined by how they themselves live their life. So one understanding the truth of karma and its effects, one realizes there's only so much you can do for another person, but you will do what you can. There's still compassion there for the person, still wishing them well.
As far as I understand, there's no obligation, compulsory obligation for the saints to teach, but they may not be kind of teaching.
Yes, so the question is that, is it that some of the saints may not be inclined to teach, and they may not teach at all? Yes, that's true. Whether it is that they see that there's no point in teaching, or whether they feel themselves unable to convey clearly enough what is the truth that they've realised, and that's the way that I understand that they realise that the truth that they've discovered is so subtle that it's very hard to convey it in a meaningful way, and there are only some teachers who can do that. So that is the difference between a Sammasambuddha, like Gautama the Buddha, who's the Sammasambuddha of this dispensation, and the Pachaka Buddha, who finds the way to enlightenment without any assistance but is then unable to teach it to others. Yes. So the manifestation of their love would be just through their interaction with society and interaction with whoever they are in contact with. So you can probably experience being in the presence of some great saint, and just being in their presence, just being around them, you feel their love and their tranquility and their peace of mind. And so it would be that sort of thing. And also, from what I understand, if anyone with the potential to understand there would come and ask them questions, they would be very willing to explain at that person's level, but not to be able to give an all-round teaching that is accessible to anyone. The Buddha's greatness was that he was able to speak at a level that was appropriate to the audience, and that people could find something that they could understand in the teaching at their level, and that they could use. Whereas the Pachaka Buddhas, from what I understand, they would certainly deal with people if they had a question, but not be able to expound the Dharma in such a grand scale. I imagine so. I'm not sure on that one. Could the Pachaka Buddha lead anyone to enlightenment? I imagine so, that would be possible if that person had the potential for that. Yes. So if we go into verse 10 of sutta number 117, where the Buddha is speaking specifically about intention, therein bhikkhu's right view comes first. And how does right view come first? One understands wrong intention as wrong intention and right intention as right intention. This is one's right view. And what bhikkhu's is wrong intention? The intention of sensual desire, the intention of ill will, and the intention of cruelty. This is wrong intention. And what bhikkhus is right intention? Right intention, I say, is twofold. There is right intention that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening on the side of attachment, and there is right intention that is noble, taintless, supermundane, a factor of the path. And what bhikkhus is right intention that is affected by taints, partaking of merit, ripening on the side of attachment, the intention of renunciation, the intention of non-ill will, and the intention of non-cruelty. This is right intention that is affected by taints on the side of attachment. This is the usual explanation of right intention, sama sankappa, in the Noble Eightfold Path. But the Buddha is saying here that it is right intention, but it's still affected by taints, the taint of what we call the taint of being or becoming, bhava asava, and the taint of wrong view, which has a sense of self in there, I am, and the ignorance which underlies that whole thing of the wrong understanding of self. So it's right intention in that it is going in the right direction, but when it's practiced with the understanding of creating good conditions in this life, and that's as far as it goes, then it isn't sufficient. And what bhikkhus is right intention that is noble, taintless, supermundane, a factor of the path? The thinking, thought, intention, mental absorption, mental fixity, directing of mind, verbal formation, whose mind is noble, whose mind is taintless, who possesses the noble path and is developing the noble path. This is right intention that is a noble factor of the path. And here this thinking, thought, intention, mental absorption, mental fixity, directing of the mind in the commentary is specifically the intention to put the mind onto the meditation object and to fix the mind onto the meditation object and to keep the mind on the meditation object until the mind reaches the point of absorption. And so the Buddha is saying here, right intention is that intention which is to do with one's meditation. And to do with one's meditation, because remember that we're looking in this sutta at what is the unification of the mind, the noble right concentration, right intention is that intention to keep working on one's meditation. And not just to keep working on it for happiness here and now, but to keep working on it to get to the point of absorption, to get to the point where one has a replacement for the happiness and pleasure that one finds in the world, and then to keep working on that until one is able to realize wisdom and move the mind further and further away from one's dependence on worldly satisfaction, seeing the world as it is, until finally one reaches the point of path moment, which is necessarily a moment at the level of jhanic absorption. So the right intention, the Buddha is saying, if you want to get noble concentration, is the intention to put the mind onto the meditation object. One makes an effort to abandon wrong intention and to enter upon right intention. This is one's right effort. So the wrong intention is towards craving, towards hurting, towards harming. The right intention is to move in the direction of renunciation, non-ill will, non-cruelty. But the super mundane right intention is to move in the direction of improving one's meditation. Mindfully one abandons wrong intention. Mindfully one enters upon and abides in right intention. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus these three states run and circle around right intention, that is right view, right effort and right mindfulness. So the last thing I would like to just read you is from the ninth sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, a teaching that Venerable Sariputta gave on the right view, which we were talking about earlier, and this is in which intention is mentioned as one of the nutriments for beings who are seeking existence and who are in existence now. Just to get the sense of how important this intention, this understanding of intention in each moment is for prolonging or sustaining our life in this existence, and also for the direction that our life is taking in the whole realm of samsara. So Venerable Sariputta is asked, would there be another line of reasoning by which a disciple of the Noble Ones is a person of right view and has arrived at this true Dharma? There would be, Venerable Sariputta says, when a disciple of the Noble Ones discerns nutriment, the origin of nutriment, the cessation of nutriment, and the way of practice leading to the cessation of nutriment, then he is a person of right view who's arrived at this true Dharma. And notice how this mirrors the first sutta we were looking at with the framework of the Four Noble Truths, where it comes from, where it's leading to, where it ceases, and the path leading to that cessation. There are these four nutriments for the maintenance of beings who have come into being, or for the support of those in search of a place to be born. Which four? Physical food, gross or refined. Contact as the second, and that mirrors that contact gives rise to intentions, gives rise to view, unwholesome and wholesome states. Contact is the second, intellectual intention the third, and consciousness the fourth. From the origination of craving comes the origination of nutriment. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of nutriment. And the way of practice leading to the cessation of nutriment is just this very noble eightfold path. Right view, right resolve, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. Now when a disciple of the Noble Ones discerns nutriment, the origin of nutriment, the cessation of nutriment, and the practice of the way of practice leading to the cessation of nutriment in this way, when having entirely abandoned passion, obsession, which is greed, sensual desire, having abandoned aversion, obsession, ill will, having uprooted the view and conceit, obsession, I am, ignorance, having abandoned ignorance and given rise to clear knowing, he has put an end to suffering and stress right here in this here and now. To this extent, too, that the disciple of the Noble Ones is a person of right view who has arrived at this true Dharma. So in this outline of nutriment, the nutriments for continued existence and for rebirth, food, physical food, all beings subsist on food, but then there is the mental food chain, and this is a use of words which I think is very good from Venerable Tanisaro, whose translation this is. He talks about the mental food chain which feeds existence, and the mental food chain is the contact. Beings have to have contact. The mind has to have contact with the world, contact also with the internal world, what's going on inside us, and then the intellectual intention. How do we give voice to the desire, the craving for existence, that is an internal experience, but then we act on it in the world. And then the third one is consciousness, the consciousness that just knows, that is in contact with this world. But the direction is the intention. And so when we are thinking about the intention, are we thinking about intention in terms of making this life more pleasant, longer lasting, happier, whatever? Are we thinking about a practice which is not only dealing with that, because we know that through karma, that if we produce wholesome conditions, we get wholesome results, but are we thinking about, is our intention to move out of this whole realm of existence? The Buddha says that's the supermundane right intention. And only if we have that will we start to try to replace the happiness that we find in the world with the happiness that we find in the mind. And then through that weakening of craving, little by little, the happiness that we find in the mind becomes stronger, and it produces a mind which is capable of seeing things as they really are. So just, yes?
Just all of what you said, this is, I'm trying to get my head around a simple way of initiating that mechanism. It's quite complex. Something actually Rama said, that if a person inclines the mind towards thoughts of letting go, inclines the mind towards thoughts of gentleness and harmlessness, inclines the mind towards thoughts of kindness, all of what you just said become more and more obvious day by day.
Yes.
So in other words, that's a very sophisticated way of explaining that. And then moment by moment, Kriman asked to keep all that in mind as you work through your daily, every day you read and all that sort of stuff. But what you're saying is that if the most operandi is those sort of mental health habits that I've just outlined, then these awarenesses will be born gradually within oneself in the moment of meditation and also outside of meditation. So
yes. So the comment is about how do we do this practically in daily life, because it seems quite involved and sophisticated, and will it become more obvious as we go through our daily life and putting it into practice? And yes, that's actually what happens. It's an unfolding. Originally I said the benchmark that the Buddha has given us with this right intention in Sankappa in the Noble Eightfold Path is the intention of renunciation, the intention of loving kindness, and the intention of compassion. And so we keep referring our reactions and our actions to that benchmark, and not with a sense of judging ourselves as a failure because we see that it's we're not doing it, or we're not living up to this standard of ideal. But basically, as we become more mindful, what is the experience of doing things that aren't with that intention in mind? What is the experience of doing things out of renunciation? What is the experience of doing things with loving kindness? What is the experience of doing things that are harmful and cruel? So through our own experience, we start to see that there's a benefit to be gained from gradually inclining the mind to more renunciation and less craving or less desire. There's something to be gained through inclining the mind towards more loving kindness and less ill will. So we start to experientially, the penny drops. It's not, and it's certainly the not intended to be like there's someone sitting in judgment saying, you're doing it right this time, you haven't done it right again. Not that at all. It's our experience of what's it like when we do it this way, what's it like when we do it that way. And then as we stick with the precepts when they're difficult, as we challenge our self-centeredness just in that point, then what's it like? How do I feel afterwards? Next time, is it easier? The things that used to overwhelm us with desire, when we say no to them, what's it like being free of that that addiction to that thing, not being able to say no to it? What's it like to be able to say no? And so as we experience that, and then we see that it's beneficial, we gradually reduce our consumption of those things or our behaviours in that direction. And then what we also start to experience is that the things that come up from the mind that colour our intentions, that give rise to our intentions, I'm going to do this, I'm going to have that, they don't come up with such force anymore because we're not acting on them in the same way. So there's a sort of loop back effect of not having to deal with so much stuff all the time, because we've been at the point of when we can make a choice in the present, we're not following those old choices. And so they don't speak to us with such loud voices like they used to. And so our life starts to get more manageable and more pleasant. And so we're receiving the benefits in our own experience, and that is the motivation to keep going in that direction. So then as everything starts to calm down, both as it arises from in producing an intention and as we react to that impulse in the mind, we don't get pushed by it so much and we don't feed it so much, then our mind is more able to find some peace in meditation as well. And we're starting to get some compensation for the work that we're doing, or some benefit that's obvious in our meditation as well. And as much as we're able to do that, it helps us to do the work in our daily life. So it's not just one thing, it's all of the things that we do together. And then as we start to see that there's something to be gained, then it's possible to start to also see that our narrow intention previously was just to try and ease our suffering in this life, try and have things a little bit more comfortable, more easy, not to be in such distress or whatever. And then we see, well, actually this is the stepping stone towards liberation completely. And so however much we can see that and however much we're inspired to do that, we start to do it not just for what it can offer us now, but recognising it has long-term benefits in the direction of liberation. I think is this saying that second jhana is the only way for or necessary way for liberation, or is this just talking about the inclination of Panchakanga's mind? That what it's actually pointing to is that the mind has to get to a point of absorption where it is no longer focused on the world of the five senses, the world externally from the mind, the world that is known through the senses, and it is that it's feeding the mind through contact. There has to be a moving in from that in order to generate the capacity to see things as they really are. And so it's not just the second jhana. The first jhana is sufficient. But when it was referring to the second jhana here, it was referring to that as the fruit of the path for the arahat. At that point, there is a pleasure that is just born out of the concentration. It's absolutely separated from the world of the five senses. And that's what that's alluding to. That's the fruit of that past moment. It's not saying you have to have that second jhana to get there. The first jhana is enough. As long as you're away from this, the world of the five senses. Yes. Yes. As long as you're separate from the five senses. So the question is, once one gets into jhana, it sounds as though it's automatic heading towards liberation, but could one become attached to that pleasure? And one can lose one's way if the jhanas are only mundane attainments, so they're not dependent on one's level of wisdom, except to the extent that one has an alternative to the pleasure that one finds in the world. But one can, because these don't necessarily lead to insight, they are a platform for insight, and they have to be practiced in conjunction with the path of insight. And then, because they can be attained as a fluke, but not maintained as a fluke. So if you're going to maintain the ability to experience jhana, then you have to see that it's not possible to attain them if you are caught up in worldly pleasure, if you're infatuated still with worldly pleasure. So that in itself is an insight.
Mm. Appears to be quite a gel with the Buddhist teaching of not having that great consciousness.
Yes.
So I just wonder if he could also attain liberation.
Well, so asking about other saints who seem to have deep absorptions but don't have the same concept of liberation in the same way as the Buddha, I'm not able to talk about their liberation or not, except to say that there are levels of absorption that speak about infinite consciousness, but it's still not liberation in terms of the Buddha's explanation of liberation. So it's quite possible that saints of this tradition or other traditions may attain those states and assume that that's a state of liberation, but it's not the state of liberation described by the Buddha. Yes, there needs to be, the jhanic platform needs to be a platform for the development of insight, wisdom. And it could be, it can be that people have a karmic inheritance that allows them to go so far and no further. That's a possibility. So, from my understanding, not having been in those realms of jhanic realms of absorption and that sort that level, I have no way of speaking from personal experience. That the insight has to be consistently and continually applied, but one would assume that unless one inclines the mind towards wisdom and the cultivation of wisdom, that one can remain in that state, because it's a very pleasant state and it makes existence in the world quite pleasant also. So being back in a normal state of consciousness is quite manageable. The world is quite manageable, so you don't go any further. And if you don't have a teacher to show you the way, then you may not have an inclination to that. So if your framework says that's the ultimate, then you may stay in that framework until a teacher comes along. So the last chapter of the Samana Mandika Putta Sutta is, I'll just read that out, verse 14. So we've looked at the way that the Buddha explains throughout this sutta that one has to know where unwholesome and wholesome states arise. One has to keep know the path to practice to come to the point where they cease without remainder. And in his explanation, that requires practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. It requires reaching stages on the path to enlightenment, and only then can one say that one's unwholesome states cease without remainder. So the final verse, which the Buddha speaks to Panchakanga the carpenter. Now, carpenter, when a man possesses what ten qualities do I describe him as accomplished in what is wholesome, perfected in what is wholesome, attained to the supreme attainment and ascetic invincible? Description of the Arahat. Here a bhikkhu possesses the right view of one beyond training, the right intention of one beyond training, the right speech of one beyond training, the right action of one beyond training, the right livelihood of one beyond training, the right effort of one beyond training, the right mindfulness of one beyond training, the right concentration of one beyond training, the right knowledge of one beyond training, the right deliverance of one beyond training. When a man possesses these 10 qualities, I describe him as accomplished in what is wholesome, perfected in what is wholesome, attained to the supreme attainment, and ascetic invincible. That is what the Blessed One said. The carpenter Panchakanga was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So one beyond training, an A-seeker, is an Arahant. And these are the qualities of an Arahant. It's not only the Noble Eightfold Path, but it is also the right knowledge of the eradication of all defilements, of all greed, hatred and delusion, and the experience of a mind that is free of greed, hatred and delusion. That's the right deliverance. So these are the 10 qualities of the fully enlightened one. So, John? The question is, what is zeal? Zeal is enthusiasm, effort, energy, striving, being really interested in doing it. So when one has zeal, one really wants to do that thing more than anything else. So one wants to... The point of these teachings on intention is that we need to develop right intention, the mundane right intention, but then to not stop there, to develop the zeal, to apply the mind for liberation. And so the intention towards the overcoming of greed, hatred and delusion, the development of the mind in meditation, is to ultimately become free of all suffering, not just to have a pleasant life here and now, or to be reborn in the heavenly realms. Yes. The driving force is seeing the unsatisfactoriness of the world and seeing, having a taste of the happiness that comes from the work of the mind in both meditation and both in developing the wisdom aspect and also the heart aspect, the understanding, but also the liberation from a self-centered approach to life is an experience of joy and happiness and freedom. The world in this way I'm calling the sensory world, the world that we can know in this mundane existence. And ultimately the liberation from all rebirth, which includes rebirth in just the realms of the mind. But if we could at least get to that stage, that would be pretty good. So there are no more questions. And please remember that these classes are intended not to answer all questions, but to raise some questions in your mind and make you think about things, maybe to see them from a different way. and certainly not intended to engender confusion, but when we are starting to look more deeply into the Buddha's teachings, there are things which we won't understand first time or first time we hear it, or even as we hear it a few times, we have to keep practicing to actually realize it for ourselves. So don't be discouraged if things seem to be just theory or just concepts or even confusing, because that's just the way it is as we start to uncover our the wisdom of the mind. So now we'd just like to chant the sharing of merits, and please, as I chant, if anyone knows the chant, chant along and take it as speaking for yourself, also sharing the merits with all beings everywhere. May the merits made by me, now or at some other time, be shared among all beings here, infinite, immeasurable, by rejoicing in this cause, this gift of merits given by me. May beings all forever live a happy life, be free from hate, and may they find the path secure, and their good wishes all succeed. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.